Hi everyone, welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. Today is October 5th, 2020. Tonight's a question and answer, so anything you want to ask me about, any topics you want me to speak on, if you are an extended family member or friend, grandparent of an Evoke participant, please let me know your relationship and your age so that I can make sure to answer the question in a way that fits with your age. All right, let's go with the first question. First question looks like comments on restoring trust after treatment when a child, young adult comes home. You know, I think one of the mistakes that I see parents make in their thinking is that they think that they have to trust somebody. And I'll talk about it maybe in just a little bit of a different way than you might have thought about it in the past or might have been taught to think about it in the past. Trust is something you get to decide. Trust is not an objective idea. And I think when we assume or even suggest that it's an objective idea, that people tend to argue about whether or not somebody is trustworthy. You know, you will argue with your child about not quite trusting, and they'll argue about their level of trustworthiness. So the shift is to begin to think about it in terms of ownership. I do or I don't trust you. I'm not ready to trust. When we argue for some kind of objective measure, some objective bar, I think that's when we get ourselves into trouble. And I don't think it's to your obligation to trust your child. I think another principle that's not intuitive that I think a lot of times we aren't taught or encouraged to think of is that part of the process is that there's going to be with children some experimentation and failure as part of the process, and that it's probably not ideal that we turn it into a kind of a cops and robbers game, kind of a cat and mouse game where we're trying to catch them and trying to be perfect about it. I'm not suggesting that it regress to the level of denial where we're ignoring signs or ignoring things, but that we have a kind of an adult mind, a parent mind, an adult or a parent filter that we look at the world through. Ideally, children can experiment within a range. When I talk about trust with parents, I often say, you know, trusting your child doesn't mean that they'll turn out the way that you want them to, but it may mean that they'll turn out in ways that you couldn't anticipate. I mean, ideally, with each generation of children, the children are growing beyond parents. I imagine most of you can identify with the idea that that you have more skills, more tools, more enlightenment than, say, your parents did. And I hope the same is true of your children, my children. I hope they get to a point where their level of growth, their level of maturity, their level of insight, of enlightenment, of evolution is beyond ours. And so trust is something that we owned. You're not obligated to trust somebody. You get to decide how much you're willing to trust. Allow for some wiggle room. Value the detours and the setbacks and the mistakes. And I'm not talking about denial. I talk about this idea about letting the child fall down, but not fall down a flight of stairs, right? And that's why, I think that's why so many of the questions that I address when parents are asking them, it's about maintaining a daily practice, right? A lifelong practice of awareness. You know, make sure that you have a support system. In my world, what that looks like is having a therapist, having a sponsor or a mentor, somebody that you can call more than you might be able to. A therapist, call them when you're feeling stressed or have questions in the moment, you know, during off hours, off business hours. But that you're committed to the fact that you're always evolving in this process. So I know parents can be held hostage by their children saying, you don't trust me, therefore I can't feel good about myself. And I think that can be a risky place for us to find ourselves in. I think micromanagement, I think anxiety, for example, can be something that can be toxic within a family, damaging within a family. And so if you find yourself very anxious a lot of the time, then make sure you're, I always say this And if you're watching me, you can see it visually. You know, make sure you're taking care of it over there, wherever over there is, with your therapist, with your sponsor, with your 12-step group, with your support group. And then when you come back here and you're relating to the child, you're not handing over your anxiety. And so I think that the worry and anxiety, if it's palpable, can absolutely be damaging to the family, to the systems, and to the individual in it. But I don't think you have to trust. And I think being held hostage by this idea that to be a good parent means you have to trust, I think is not necessarily a rational thought process. But it becomes a problem when we blame the child, when we blame others for how much we trust, instead of saying, this is my comfort level. You know, the big shift is changing from a kind of who's right and who's wrong paradigm to the idea of ownership, the idea of being a self. This is what I feel comfortable and what I don't feel comfortable. I saw a quote. In fact, one of our therapists shared this, Cassidy. Maybe you can look it up. One of our therapists shared a quote from Albert Einstein today that said, you know, you can't solve a problem with the same level of consciousness. You have to kind of have a higher level of consciousness to solve a problem. And that's really what Evoke's parent work is about. It's about evolving and moving to a different level of consciousness. That's what we're striving for. We're striving for evolution, for change. And I'm not talking about kind of a first order change. I'm not talking about a skill-based change or an idea or a tool here and there. I'm talking about a different way of being and participating in the world. So with that in mind, we have to kind of evolve beyond our old ways of thinking, beyond the old ways that we were taught to think and taught to conceptualize things. All right, the next question that comes in is, what is a check-in? This is an easy... A check-in is as informal as how are you feeling? And you can answer that question any way that you want. Now, participants at Evoke get taught more formally about a check-in using the five steps of a feeling statement that wasn't invented by us, is not unique to Evoke, and that is how you're feeling, what the event is, what your belief is, what you hope inside your control, and what you hope outside of your control is. If you want more about that, it's in my book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent. We have podcasts, we have webinars on it. You can go to YouTube or go to our podcast channel to learn about communication theory and modeling. So a more formal check-in would be to say, I feel this way because, or when, I feel this way because I think is step three, and then what I hope for myself and what I hope for others. But it can be as simple as, just thinking about it in terms of what's going on for you right now. It can be as informal as that. It's not that quote, Cassidy, not the one about the fish. That's also by Einstein and also a great one. But it was about consciousness. It's about not solving a problem in the same level of consciousness. If you can find it, great. If not, hopefully my summarizing made enough sense. Next question gets asked, how do you prevent kids from running away at night? This comes from the mother of a 16-year-old boy. You know, we take their shoes at night. We don't make it impossible. If we perceive them to be, or they have a history of running away, we absolutely will place them on a level of watch where they have to sleep right next to the staff, and we lay a tarp over the top of their sleeping bag, and staff sleep on each side of the student, so that if the student wakes up at night, the staff will feel and hear them wake up at night. That's if somebody's on a heightened supervision level. But for the typical student, you know, it's interesting because when I started in wilderness therapy in the mid-1990s, we definitely had a kind of a cat and mouse. We would talk with the students about how impossible it was to run or get back to town, or the fact that we had search teams at the ready with dogs that could find their scent. We talked about horses and helicopters, and all of that was true and at our disposal ultimately. But when we opened up Evoke, when we opened up our program in the late 1990s, we realized that we're not going to play it that way anymore. We're not going to play pit ourselves against the students, and we're going to have less of a this idea that we can stop and prevent and catch you. And we eventually essentially say, if you're not on watch, if you're not on some kind of run watch, you can try to run, and you might even get back to town. You might find somebody who's hunting or camping, and they might give you a ride back into town. You might even make it home, which is extraordinarily exceptional. I don't know if that's ever happened in 20 years. Maybe once 15 years ago or so, one student made it back home. But the fact of the matter is, what are you running from and where are you going? And you'll end up back here anyway. So we don't try to make it for the typical average student. We don't try to make it a cat and mouse game. If somebody is at risk because that's their inclination, is to run away and to physically run from their problems, then we'll have a heightened level of supervision where they won't have their shoes and they'll be flanked by two staff members day and night, one during the day and two at night. So, and it happens once in a while. I probably, you know, of the 1,000 or 1,100 students or so that I had in my own caseload, I probably had, 50 run attempts out of that 1,100. And almost inevitably, almost every time, it became an exercise in futility for the student. There was the experience one way or another where they realized this was their pattern and there was nowhere to go. And oftentimes it was an important critical point in their therapy where things improved after that. So we don't try to make it a game for them, but we try to protect those that are vulnerable to it. And ultimately, if they've earned their way off of that heightened supervision or that run watch, we just find them and bring them back. Typically, they'll find us, or they'll call. They'll find somebody camping or somebody hunting out there, and they'll borrow a cell phone and try to get home. And we'll just bring them back to the group and just kind of point out to them, have it be a kind of experientially a lesson in the futility of trying to run from your problems. My son is in week 8 at Cascades. He will be 18 in December. Do you have any advice to free? Do you have any advice to free if he refuses aftercare? My husband and he are having a very difficult time. They are only speaking when forced to. My husband is doing his work. He took a year off of work to focus on our family. Our therapist recommended my son and I live separately from my husband until my son is ready to be successful and independent. Any thoughts on this idea? Your staff is amazing, and I am grateful. Well, that's a lot of really kind of heavy work that you're doing. When I talk about these, I don't put these up all the time, but I can't really get into specific recommendations. Your Evoke therapist should be able to help you work through that, that process. I'll just tell you this, that, at some point the process is, whether it's 18, before 18, at some point every parent will get to a point where they will have tried introducing their child to everything that the parent knows that can be helpful. And at some point the child is going to sink or swim. The parents that are involved at Evoke, you're at the point where you're trying a tremendous, you're exhausting a tremendous amount of resources. You're doing the fact that you're on the broadcast tonight and asking questions. These are significant expenditures of your resources, financially, emotionally, intellectually, and so forth. And so, with that, you'll get to a point where you kind of let go and turn it over to the child. I don't trust that children who turn 18, almost all of them will threaten. They're going to walk away. We encourage parents that if they feel it's necessary or helpful to set a boundary of what they will and won't support, that's your decision. Nobody can make it for you. You'll get recommendations from the therapist about holding boundaries with your children. I will tell you that most of the students that we've worked with over the years, that they will threaten and hopefully try to call your bluff. They'll assume that you're bluffing, especially if you're like most of us and you have a history of capitulating when things get difficult, which most of us struggle with. So find out what your boundary is. Find out what you can and can't support. And ultimately, you know, you let go. Ultimately, I talk about this in a different context, but, you know, I talk a lot about how we dent our children. We metaphorically dent and bruise our children, and how no child, no parent can escape that process. It's just a fact. But perhaps more important to that idea is that at a certain point, the dents are the child's to deal with. The dents are yours. They're worthy of your explanation. In fact, there was a quote that was offered on our Instagram and our Facebook social medias that was written by Jamie Gill, where she says just that. You know, nobody comes from a perfect context, whatever that is. Everybody's childhood includes dents and bruises, and those are worthy of exploration. But the dents are yours at some point. And so however imperfect you are, and all of us fit somewhere on the continuum of imperfection, and however imperfect you are, eventually there's a time when we hand it over to the child. We try to be available. We try to support them. We try to listen and be accountable for our contribution, but not to the extent that we handicap them, not to the extent that we ultimately, as they grow up, take responsibility for their lives. You know, that's part of growing up. That's part of becoming an adult. So I know that doesn't specifically give you advice about aftercare and resources, but all of you, it's a daily work. There's no one question, one answer to one question that I can give anybody that's going to last them forever. You've kind of got to, it's going to be a living, our growth, our awareness is a living organism. At any point that we imagine, fantasize, where we arrive, we're lost. We're done, right? It has to be alive. Somebody asked the question, what do the kids eat out there? Typical meals, mother of a 16-year-old participant, just 1 week in. Let me see if I have this. I wonder if I have this resource. Let's see if I have a typical day. I thought I had a typical day and I was going to give you that. Vegetables, fruits, grains, beans, rice. They have some fatty foods like peanut butter, cheese. Because out there they need the fatty foods to help their body stay warm, to access, to be able to exercise, metabolize, to keep their body functioning. So we try to be as organic when we can. We try to be local when we can. They have fresh meat twice a week. They have canned or packaged meat like tuna or chicken for several of the other days. They eat group meals for breakfast and for dinner, and then they have lunch food that is given to them twice a week. So it's low in sugar, low in preservatives, fresh fruits and vegetables every day. So it's not like they're on a diet, but it's not processed food and fast food. It's a better diet than most clients are eating when they're out of here. And the dinners I think are great. I don't like the breakfast. They have oats and granola for breakfast in the morning a lot of mornings, and that to me is not that great tasting. Lunch is fine because there's a lot of tortillas, peanut butter, chicken, tuna, and then they have trail mix. Dinner's really tasty. They do a good job with beans and rice and sometimes some bacon and cheese, and they make burritos a lot of the week, and it's really, really good, actually. And then they have, like I said, meat night a couple of nights per week. We have two food drop-offs, and every day that they get to a new location, backup is making sure that they have fresh fruits and vegetables for every day. Grandmother of a 16-year-old at Evoke says, could you please speak about the different phases of the program as what is involved in each? Absolutely. So the first few days, handful of days, we call Earth Phase. And on Earth Phase, they're not integrated into the group at large. They're watching the group from 15, 20 feet away. They're not interacting with the group socially. They're just kind of watching and learning. And they have some self-reflective assignments to work on. They're immediately assigned a mentor. One of the more experienced members of the group does come over and spend time with them, teaches them how to keep their fire, if they have a fire, to eat their meals, make sure that they know how to use all of their gear. They are closely monitored by one particular staff. One staff is assigned to them, so they're constantly monitoring them and watching them, and they're in charge. They're also having long conversations. So the first 2 to 5 days typically are this kind of intense one-on-one focus. Mentor, staff member, the new participant. After that, they finish their basic assignments that about a life story about what got them to Evoke and goals that they want to work on. After some very basic assignments, then they enter into the group socially. Each phase of the program is marked by a transition ceremony. The first couple are fairly scripted. The first ceremony to welcome them to Earth phase, everybody gives them a gift from the Earth of symbolic of something that has to do with the program, a smooth rock, right? A piece of an evergreen tree. And they choose it themselves, and they talk about the symbol of it. In fire phase, then the second phase, when they move into the group socially, they're given a fire set where they learn how to rub sticks together to make fire. It's called a bow drill fire set. And everybody has to donate part of their own working set so that the new member of the group has their own fire set to begin with. And after that, they have to cultivate their pieces, and then they eventually volunteer their pieces to the new students in the group. And fire phase is really about accountability. Fire phase is just about being honest with yourself. It's about learning group norms, making sure that you're staying safe, and you're respecting the kind of group expectations and norms of the group. There's a percentage of students that never get out of fire phase. That's kind of the main phase of the program. If students are more invested, they'll make it to the water phase. So maybe somewhere around 60% of the students graduate on fire phase, and then probably another 30% get to water phase. This is give or take. And then 10% will make it to the last phase, air phase. Water phase is about investment. Water phase starts to be about leadership, modeling. You know, they're not just being accountable, but they're actually beginning to taste, to appreciate the virtues of their mental health growth and tools. So it's starts to be intrinsically valuable for them. And then air phase, that 10% category, is rare. You know, we didn't design 4 phases of the program so that most of the students will get to the end. And we did that on purpose, very consciously, from the beginning, because it's a lifelong journey. You know, really, in fact, some of my most challenged, my students who were the most challenged by the phases were the ones that did get to air phase, because they imagined to themselves that they were done, that they were finished, that they had arrived. And so air phase is its own challenge. You start to get future information. You can even lead a hike and have a map and compass, and lead a hike physically. You can even be part of staff groups where you're talking about interventions for other students. So you really embrace leadership and future focus. And that's hard to stay present while you're thinking and talking about others and the future. So that's a little bit about the 4 phases. There are academic curriculum associated with all of the phases. There are hard skills like building things with leather and the bow drill fire, for example, crafts. There's service projects. And then there's something we call soft skills, which are, you know, the way that they're talking, their use of language, communication skills, insight, leading a group. Those are kind of the soft skills. So they have soft skills, therapeutic skills, hard skills, which are kind of the primitive living skills. And then there's the academic curriculum that are a part of, make up all of the curriculum. (Clears throat) Any other questions, Cassidy? For now, I can go up to upcoming announcements and then we can go back to. I'll do that while we're waiting, while Cassidy's telling me if we have another one. If you're interested in doing your own work, we have a program that's completely separate from our wilderness therapy program. We call it an intensive program in Northern Utah. If you come, want to come and do your own work, if any of this sounds interesting to you and you want to just delve into your own work, the last broadcast I did last week on parent work will tell you a little bit about what I mean when I say your work. We have them online and in person with special COVID protocols. Upcoming dates we have online is October 23rd. And then in person, I'm actually going to be running the one in person in November, November 11th through 15th. I was thinking about it today. It's great timing. As the holidays are approaching, to do some of your own work, Ram Dass said, the guru Ram Dass said, that if you think you're enlightened, spend a week with your family. So in preparation for a time when many people are going to be spending time, extended periods of time with family, November 11th through 15th is just about perfect. So I'll be running that one. More questions, go to our website or email intensives@evoketherapy.com. Pursuits trips are adventure trips for families or young adults, anywhere from 3 days to 30 days. Some families are using this program for their in-between time because the program, the wilderness program, is having no outside visitors during COVID. So you can go anywhere in the world. We've had them in Nepal. We've had them in South America, Central America, British Columbia. There's a lot of great adventure in Utah. If you want to spend a few days with your child, with some staff that have experience in doing what, these are run by our former staff members. So if you want to do something, you can pick your own activities like whitewater rafting, rappelling, horseback trail riding, whatever you want, anywhere, fly fishing, anywhere in the world. Pursuits adventure trips are for you. Think sober fun or therapy light. We have online support groups during COVID for parents, current parents and alumni parents. So I've just listed them here. The next one is this Thursday, October 8th at 6:30 p.m. Mountain Time. The live webinars, we have one or two per week. And then we have online support groups for alumni of our intensive programs. If you have questions, you can go to our website or email malia@evoketherapy.com for more information. We ask all current parents to go to 6 12-step support groups, any combination of Al-Anon, CODA, Families Anonymous, or Adult Children. You can also go to refugerecovery.org or NAMI.org for other support groups and resources in your local community that are free. All of these broadcasts are available on the podcast app. Just go to your favorite podcast platform and search Finding You and Evoke Therapy Podcast. 350 podcast episodes new each week. Or you can go to soundcloud.com and look at them and listen to them from your computer. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram for information, parent resources, inspirational quotes, photos, articles, references to blogs from staff and from families. On Twitter and Instagram, you can find us either at Evoke Therapy or at Evoke Therapy Intensives. Same on Facebook, either search us by searching Evoke Therapy Programs or Evoke Therapy Intensives. And then you can find the Evoke Family Foundation at evokefamilyfoundation.org or on Facebook. This is an organization of alumni families that help raise money for people who can't afford therapy. Also, our Evoke Therapy blog helps. My two books, The Journey of the Heroic Parent and The Audacity to Be You, are available on Amazon. So if you're interested in more in the work, want to get into it, those books. The Journey of the Heroic Parent was written really from my perspective of as being a wilderness therapist and a parent. And The Audacity to Be You is kind of the more focused on my intensive work, the work that all of us have, regardless of whether or not we have children or not. I think both of them apply to all of us and all our relationships, but I wrote The Audacity to Be You this year with that in mind. All right, more questions? Someone says, how much do they move around? Are they moving around during Earth phase quarantine? I forgot about the quarantine phase, actually. We do have a quarantine phase that's even before the group, that's just unique to COVID. They're not moving around during COVID, during quarantine. During Earth phase, they're moving around typically the same amount they're moving around during any program, any part of the program. We ask them to move 4 to 5 days a week. 2 days a week specifically, while the therapist is there, they don't move. That's when we're doing a lot of our reading and writing assignments, where the therapist is out in the field, running groups, running individual sessions, going over letters from home to home, writing assignments, reading assignments, and so forth. So two what we call layover days, and then 4 or 5 days a week, we want them to be moving, to be breaking down camp, moving and setting up a camp somewhere else. Quarantine, they do not move. Someone says, since there are in-person intensives, are there in-person parent workshops and visits? No, online. Online parent workshops for right now. No in-person visits. We might evolve to that point, but we worry that if COVID gets into the program, that its spread could be really damaging to the program, that it could spread without and be very difficult to manage. So unfortunately, you know, we believe in visits. We were the first wellness therapy program of any of them in the country, anywhere, to have parents come out and visit the field regularly. It's pretty typical, but we were the first ones to do it. So we believe in it. But right now during the program, visits are not allowed. And in-person parent programming is not allowed. It's going to be virtual. And you can have virtual FaceTime calls, Zoom calls with your child. Therapists are trying to do some creative stuff with electronics around seeing and talking to your child and watching your child share with you a typical day, but no in-person visits in parent groups right now. Sorry about that. Any other questions, Cassidy? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I'm happy to take any questions, even if it's very personal. Someone writes in, our son made several attempts of hurting himself during the first week. He tried to smash his hand with a rock, tried to kick something and break his foot, tried to break his other hand at the doctor's when they were going for an x-ray. Does this happen often? What type of counseling is he receiving for this? Hopefully he realizes this will not get him his ticket home. He's been there for 1 week so far. Mother of a 16-year-old. It doesn't happen often, but it's interesting because I remember those students of mine who are like your son more vividly than some of the others because of course, the dramatic nature of their attempts to kind of escape their pain, escape the program. So that's not typical. But it's not, it doesn't mean that they're not going to make progress. You know, I've had students try to burn themselves with fire, with a hot stick, like you said, to try to break something, try to get frostbite, all kinds of things. And it's just, you know, a way to think about symptoms or substances or escapes is it's an attempt to not be present in your own life. I mean, think about that. It's an attempt not to be present in your own life. And the great psychologist Carl Jung said that neuroses is a substitute form for legitimate suffering. In other words, that all of these attempts, although they look like suffering, you know, whether it be self-harming, kind of cutting is more common prior to the program, but not what you're describing. It's just an attempt to not be present, to not feel. And I know that the things that you're describing with your son hurt physically, but they hurt more than him dealing with whatever he needs to deal with. And I don't know what that is. And so in a way, everybody's the same. Whether somebody is suicidal or self-harming or dramatically like you're describing, trying to find their way out of the program, it's the same kind of psychology. What's going on? What are you trying to escape from? What's the feeling that's beneath it? How are you feeling? Are you feeling out of control? Is this a way to get control? And so, you know, mental health, one indication of mental health is when we see the similarities between ourselves and others. I saw a really cool quote today that I actually shared on my social media that said, I'll read it to you because it was so good that it deserves to be read exactly as is. Just two lines. It says, the questioner asked the question, how are we to treat others? And I don't know, I looked up this person before I posted it, and I'll try to pronounce it correctly, but he was a guru from India, Ramana Maharshi. He responded with, there are no others. So how do we treat others? And then he responded, there are no others. After a while, you just don't see the differences. You see the similarities. And the participants will look at each other and they'll say, look, I didn't use drugs or I wasn't aggressive at home, but let me tell you how we are the same. And that's really an indication of mental health. So while your son's behavior might be more dramatic than others, he shares more in common with others than he does differences. And they see that. Someone says, I would love to see a teen version of The Audacity to Be You, but until then, do you have any specific chapters, sections that you think might resonate with teens? The whole book was great, but I know my son would not pick it up unless specific sections were divided for him. I don't know. I don't know if it lends itself to teens or the adolescent brain, if you will. You know, they like stories. The two books that are standard in the program are the ones that I would recommend, The Knight in Rusty Armor or Viktor Frankl, which is much more advanced, especially the second part where he talks about the theory, Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. But children / teens and the adolescent brain is considered to be the adolescent brain until around the age of 25. They like stories and memoirs better. You know, they don't gravitate towards self-help as often. It wasn't really written for them. You're right. I don't know that there's something that would grab them. They'd have to be pretty motivated and they'd have to want to think about things in a pretty advanced way. So yeah, that's my answer. But that's an interesting thought and an interesting question. In fact, somebody, my therapist wrote a sequel to the Knight in Rusty Armor called The Letters of Juliet. It's about letters from the white wife to the Knight in Rusty Armor. And somebody encouraged me to write a story from the son's perspective. And maybe I'll write a short story from the son as it relates to children in the wilderness. If he hasn't seen Finding Joe, it's on, I think it's on YouTube for free right now, or you can get it on for $3 on the Apple Store or on Amazon. Finding Joe, it's a film by Patrick Solomon. It's a wonderful, accessible film. That might be a nice thing to show him also. All right. Thanks for joining me tonight. The next broadcast will be this Wednesday, October 7th. I'm doing it a little bit earlier so that if you want to watch the vice presidential debate, you are able to. So it'll start at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, and I'll be talking about existential philosophy and therapy this Wednesday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, October 7th. So as always, thank you for joining us. Thank you for and on behalf of your family members for being willing to do your work. It's the greatest gift. Like Ram Dass said, the only thing that I can do for you is work on me, and the only thing you can do for me is work on you. So thank you for that gift. I hope these broadcasts are a helpful point of contact in the middle of the week. Take care, folks, and I'll talk to you Wednesday. Bye-bye. Bye.